The most difficult part of this process is that for a Mandiant Consulting investigation, no two are identical. So you're having to distill that information and categorize it, and you have potentially super desperate pieces of information that you're trying to pull these trends and be able to distill that information down from.
All right, welcome to another episode of the Ion Security Podcast. I'm your host, Luke McNamara. Joining me today to talk about the latest MTrends report, we have Steve Stone, Senior Director for Advanced Practices, and Regina Elwell, Senior Principal Threat Analyst on the Advanced Practices team. Steve, Regina, how are you today?
Good, good. Thanks for having us.
Good, Luke. How about you?
I am doing well. And where I think makes sense to begin with this conversation about the latest MTrends report, newly released, is maybe first talk a little bit about the process. And I think to do that well, it'd be great to hear a little bit about your team, the Advanced Practices team, what you guys are working on, and your role specifically in putting this report together.
Regina and I both work on the Advanced Practices team inside of FireEye. So we are an internal team designed to provide direct support, and then really do across all of FireEye a combination of decision-making based around threats and technology, and then active pursuit and illumination of a range of adversaries. Our overall team mission is pretty straightforward. It's just know more about the adversary than anyone and make that knowledge actionable for FireEye. So really what we're here to do is work with each of the distinct business units, IR, managed defense, product, those directly helping our clients around preventing, responding, remediating to intrusions. We provide direct support to the incident response and managed defense engagements. And then we also provide back to those organizations some context and larger picture of what they're seeing in a specific engagement. We try to bring all of FireEye's intrusion knowledge to those engagements and then take those engagements back, make that part of the larger FireEye knowledge store. And really what we do in Advanced Practices is we focus on the intrusion deltas. What are we seeing? Is it all known before? Have we not run across it? Do we need to expand the attribution surface area for the technical intrusions? Do we need to deploy weak signals and surface underreported intrusions, close those deltas, and then move on to the next intrusion event? So really, MTrends is pretty near and dear to our heart because this is really a manifestation of our daily work that we do with all these other teams across FireEye. And it's really neat as a company to then get to work with those same teams, putting together MTrends and be a part of that holistic view.
I think it's certainly the most quantitative intensive report that we produce every year. So I always enjoy reading it when it comes out and seeing the particular things that we identified as notable trends across the threat landscape and broken down in all the different ways that you do so. We'll get into that a little bit, but I'm curious, like, the actual process of putting this together, because I know this is a months-long endeavor. These sort of cumulative threat landscape reports are becoming commonplace, I think, across the industry. But this is a report that we've been producing since 2011. How do you start with, you know, looking at what are the data sets we're going to include in this? And this is obviously focused on breach data. But when you think about all the different parts of the report, the case studies, how does that all come together in terms of the planning and the process that you think about with the execution of this report?
So to address the timeline, MTrends is an everyday, year-long effort for Advanced Practices. Like Steve said, it's a direct manifestation of our day-to-day work. The report itself takes probably 4 to 6 months to compile, but throughout the year, we're categorizing, classifying all that frontline incident response data to be able to pull metrics after the reporting period is complete. Right now, we're already 7 months into the MTrends 2022 reporting period to kind of put that into perspective. And so, like, the data itself, we are providing that community with information that we're seeing on the front lines, and all the metrics are derived from actual incident response investigations. So Mandiant Consulting investigations, so direct work product of that. And it takes a huge effort for us to distill all that information, to vet it, to analyze it, to categorize it, and then put it back into our company knowledge bank. And then when it comes to writing the report, we're looking at all right, what are the trends? What's changed year over year? Is there another subset of data that we should be looking at that we maybe haven't delved in before? And also looking, like, now we're doing the process of looking for next year. Was there something that maybe we wanted to account for this year that we didn't have a way to track that we should be tracking for next year? I guess ransomware is a good example of that for this year, that we saw that ransomware was much more prevalent this year compared to the 2020 reporting period compared to previous years. And so we broke out ransomware specific metrics to show those numbers for that.
Yeah, that's something I definitely want to get into, is some of the, I think, unique insights from this past year. And the story that I think you guys did a very excellent job in telling, where there was a lot of nuanced language and breaking down things like the dwell time, but separating out how ransomware has played a part in that. But first, I guess one of the questions I have, again, back more around the process aspect of this, how have you seen this report change over the years? So this is a report that obviously we've been producing for some time. I went back actually before this and looked up the very first, the 2011 report. And there's some things that some of the language and aspects of it that certainly are still pertinent today. But the amount of data that you see in this report now is by far and away a lot more than the kind of early versions. But I'm curious, any sort of insights that you've seen with just how the report itself has morphed over the years?
It's definitely an iterative process. I mean, you can see the evolution report to report, and every year we end up adding some sort of extra metric. It seems like it very rarely do we drop a metric. It's just like every year we're adding more and more, trying to give the community more insights into what we're seeing to be able to have a better grasp on what is truly a trend year to year, what is an anomaly. And it has been interesting to say, like, this year, adding that ransomware metric, because it is a very important component to that threat landscape and staying with the most relevant metrics for the community. Yeah.
I think also, just, you know, kind of piggybacking on Regina's comments, one of the really interesting things as we've worked MTrends has been the ability to take things that we see and really provide visibility to that. I think one of the real guiding principles we have for MTrends as a company is, this is a show our work kind of product. We don't want to just say, hey, you should think about this, or hey, what about that? We want to actually provide context on why we are saying this is important. Here's some things to look at. Here's some priorities, some of those aspects. And ultimately, that, I think, is Luke, to your comment about the volume, especially on the metrics, has just a kind of increased year over year. That's been very intentional. And again, back to Regina's earlier comment about this as a daily thing across different teams, where we're really trying to drive workflow changes forward and use MTrends to do that. So as we've gotten better at things as a company, you can see products like MTrends get more robust, but all while keeping that kind of mentality of Kevin and Jürgen in particular are huge proponents of, this is our chance to be very open with the larger industry and our clients and organizations that don't have anything to do with us. And you can really hopefully see that come through in this document. This is definitely designed to be a show your work kind of manifestation of the company's efforts.
You mentioned this is an ongoing process, and this is something that your team is obviously tracking and focused on every day, not just the period where you're putting together the report itself. But I'm curious, are there any particular data sets that maybe are more intensive or difficult to kind of sift through and collate when you're putting the report together itself, where that starts to be some of the more intensive parts of the work?
The most difficult part of this process is that for a Mandiant consulting investigation, no two are identical. So you're having to distill that information and categorize it, and you have potentially super desperate pieces of information that you're trying to pull these trends and be able to distill that information down from. So not knowing what customer logs you're going to have, or what is provided during the investigation, or what's discovered. And because it could be anything and anything under the sun that we then have to standardize and put in some sort of uniform format to be able to have that metadata to pull metrics from. So just the threat landscape itself and how different it is makes the whole process of pulling metrics on that difficult.
So you mentioned ransomware, and this, I guess, gets into some of the takeaway pieces of the actual report itself. I think probably I'm not alone in this, but every time this report comes out, I think the first thing I virtually flip to is the dwell time metric and see how that's changed. And I think that's probably one of the pieces of this report that's probably most well known. Can you talk a little bit about what's sort of unique about that this year? Because it seems like there's a little bit of good news, bad news, the bad news being how ransomware has impacted that. But then, you know, some positive news, at least compared to last year in terms of internal detections trending back up.
Yeah, so for internal detection, absolutely, companies are doing a much better job of detecting those incidents without that first notification coming from that external source. So they're doing it in-house. They're developing those capabilities. But also something that is in those numbers that we had to kind of tease out is that ransomware is a factor in that improvement number, because ransomware threat actors have no desire to stay quiet in the environment. It's destructive. It's loud. Their goal is to get paid. And the only way they're going to get paid is if they draw attention to that breach. So definitely there's some percentage of that is impacted by that ransomware. And we see that in the dwell time too. There's no need for a ransomware threat actor to stay super stealth for extended periods of time in an environment if their goal is to get in, get access to as many systems as possible, encrypt everything, and then demand money. It's a completely different type of threat that you're defending against compared to some sort of espionage, long-term intrusion that their goal is to be in there collecting information over extended periods of time to stay stealth. So seeing that dwell time number drop drastically definitely is impacted by a huge spike, that continued surge of ransomware in like the proportion of investigations that are responding to.
I think too, as we talk about, especially at the global level, the global median dwell time, one of the things, as we talk about that a lot internally, and even then we do follow on specific engagements around how to interpret and use that data. The biggest thing I think we get sometimes is this really is designed to talk about everybody, the global scale of that. So we get the question all the time of, we've actually gotten a few of these this year. You know, as a company, we're saying, hey, we think this 24 days global median dwell time for this MTrends is significant. We think it speaks to both ransomware and also client improvement, industry improvement, whole of government improvement. And then I can't speak for every one of the presentations we've done, but all of them that I've been in, we get the question of, well, that's too long. An attacker can do a lot in 24 days. Shouldn't that be under insert timeframe? And our position is, yeah, absolutely. But those two things are very different. What we're not saying is, hey, 24 days for an attacker in an environment is great. What we are saying is this year over year over year improvement going from 416 days down to 24 in this time frame is significant. And it does speak to a holistic, larger improvement. I think that's one of the things as we talk about this that can be easy to get overlooked, because we're kind of wired that way. We deal with single environments. We deal with our company, our organization, our breach. And we really want to use MTrends to talk about, when you put all that together, what are we seeing across all of those events? And then I cannot reinforce what Regina said enough about, as we look at dwell time and detection by source, which we assessed years ago, those were important because they were impactful. And we continue that forward. It really comes down to organizations that can find their own intrusion are typically better prepared to deal with that intrusion. And you see that play out in global median dwell time. The difference from 24 days then into the external versus internal categories is stark. I mean, internal detection is half of that global dwell time at 12 days. External notification is more than three times that average at 73 days, I think, off the top of my head. So that's one of those things I think is also easy to get lost, because it looks like a different way to track, but it really does speak to all the questions we get all the time across every business unit. What can clients do to help themselves? What can clients do to be better prepared? And that's why we talk about internal detection, external notification. That is one of those things we think is the most important, is put the effort there, put the resources there, and you can see the dividends on those investments, or conversely, what happens when you're reliant on other organizations.
So this is one of the things in particular I really wanted to pick both your brains about, because that internal detection metric, I think you're right, a lot of people look at as a sort of proxy not just in the United States, but when you're looking at the specific regions that you have broken out, as an increase in organizational maturity and the capability of organizations in these different regions to be able to deal with different types of cyber threats. So it's an improvement over last year, the uptick in the number of internal detections. But looking at it for the last several years, it seems like it's kind of flatlined a little bit, hovering around that 40%. It's gone up and down a little bit, but obviously a big improvement from where we were in 2011. But do you think that we are starting to see a sort of normalization of the amount of internal detection? And again, kind of viewing that as a soft metric for the capacity of organizations to detect those threats internally, and then conversely, a metric for their maturity and their capability. Are we kind of evening off at this point, or do you think we'll continue to see a downward trajectory?
Yeah, great question. So I would say off the top, I'm not sure. So everything I can give you is an opinion, right? I mean, looking forward in the intrusion landscape is always challenging, because every year we kind of think we know what the next year brings, and then we're writing M trends and we've learned that there's a bunch of stuff that came up that we didn't see. And this year proves no different. So on the detection by source, I think we're definitively in an area where we don't expect massive jumps one way or the other. I would be shocked if we're writing M trends 2022 and the internal detection is at 80%. I just don't foresee that. We would hope to see that kind of incremental improvement, and it just kind of keeps working and working and working. And again, this is easy to take this discussion around detection by source and have it turn into what's wrong with a certain org. But again, I think this also, there's a whole element here that we openly advocate for as a company. We want other entities to be involved. We openly advocate for industry regulations. We openly advocate for government actions. Those entities and those actions then produce external notifications. That's great. That's not a bad news story in and of itself. We want governments to improve. We want industry partners to improve. We want our competitors and peers in the vendor landscape to improve. That helps clients. That helps everybody. So I think that that's a piece as well. And those are very difficult things to forecast. It's almost impossible to know how, let's just take the government piece. Those changes take years to manifest, especially in a holistic way. I mean, look at last week. The week that we rolled out M-Trends, we're dealing with government takedowns of web shells. We're dealing with government arrests and significant sentencing for Fin7 personnel. We're dealing with government sanctions in part because of breaches that we talk about in M-Trends. Those things we did not forecast would all happen the week that we rolled out M-Trends. They're just very difficult to forecast and when they'll manifest. And then again, it's almost impossible to know what other vendors are working on that will then produce these positive impacts. So that one's kind of tough, but what we would hope for and expect is kind of an incremental improvement year over year. We just don't think there's going to be a big thing that's going to come in and swing everything. We've all kind of been doing this long enough that those silver bullets just don't exist. So we then look for what are these incremental progressions that help on these really, really difficult topics. And oh, by the way, the bad guys get a vote too. They innovate just as hard as the rest of us do. And ideally, some of that comes through in this M-Trends. You can look at just the ransomware stuff we discuss alone. We used to discuss just a couple of years ago, ransomware is a fairly monolithic action. If you look at M-Trends, especially in some of the case studies, you can see we spent a lot of time talking about the evolution of how actors are using that, the evolution of the deployment timeframes alone. So there's a lot of players involved who get a lot of votes, which make forecasting that pretty difficult.
Yeah, and there's obviously a lot of factors even in the sort of data collection there of where our customers are that we pull this data from, you know, the specific regions they're in, even the industries that they're in, that all could have an impact on their organizational maturity. But I think it is an interesting thing to look at year over year, how that specific metric changes, and then what that could be telling us, again, if you view it somewhat as a metric for the overall capacity of the organization to deal with and respond to threats. And is that maturity going up or down in certain regions? I think it's interesting to look at. We talked about ransomware. I think the metric in there was about 14% of the incidents that we responded to last year, or in 2019 rather, involved ransomware of some kind. And that jumped up to 25% last year. What's the sort of, I mean, it seems to be that no one's expecting that to slow down anytime soon. But was there any kind of noticeable trends from what we saw in terms of further actors entering the space, or obviously a big shift in the tactics we saw last year was just how creative they got with extortion. But what were some of the big takeaways from ransomware this past year?
I think when we look at ransomware, the first trend is the one you just mentioned. I mean, we just see more of it. I mean, that jump from 14 to 25% of all the incident response engagements that we worked and addressed in this MTrends period, that's pretty significant. I mean, we're dealing with one out of four. And again, as Regina mentioned, we're 7 months into the next MTrends. Back of the napkin math seems to be that that increase is continuing into the next MTrends. So we'll see, right? Fingers crossed, we'll see how that goes. But the thing I would say with the ransomware as big trends is there's a reason these numbers are going up. And I think when we look at the motivation section, I mean, I really think it's important to pair the ransomware discussion with other parts of what we see in MTrends and then just obviously in event response. It's working. That's why it's prevalent. I mean, I don't want to be overly simplistic with it, but if you look at the section we talk about attacker trends and some of those areas, if you look at just the motivation piece, the highest single motivation percentage that we assess is financial gain. If ransomware pays off, actors are going to use it. They're motivated to make money. And that's not new. And they're just finding what they believe is the best, most effective way to do that. And what we're seeing is there's more and more of those actors that are assessing that ransomware is the way to do that. It is just that simple at some point. And again, I know that runs the risk of being overly simplistic, but these actors are doing this to get paid, period. Some high majority of them. And if ransomware gets it done, if that generates them more money or more money per intrusion or in an easier way, great. Again, I'll keep kind of stealing Regina's thunder. She mentioned that the point that a ransomware actor can show up and move very fast in an environment because they know they're going to get caught because they're going to deploy encryptors and it will be very obvious. That's got benefits if you're a bad guy compared to an espionage intrusion. You can just do things and not have to do things that traditional actors have had to be focused on. I think we would be remiss if we didn't recognize those elements have a direct contribution to the uptick in ransomware.
One of the things I thought was actually interesting in one of the metrics around ransomware was noting a decrease in ransomware in APAC year over year from 2019 to 2020. And I think it makes sense when you think about, again, actors gravitating to where the money is, as you mentioned. Certainly that's going to be in the type of threat activity that they are going to take part in if they're financially motivated. But it also makes sense, and I think we've seen this in the past with banking trojans and other forms of cybercrime, where they also gravitate to the regions where they can maximize the most amount of gains. I'm curious if anything that you've been seeing so far into this year suggests that we might see ransomware. It's certainly not alone. I mean, the Americas is certainly not the only region where we've seen ransomware, and, you know, EMEA and APAC as well. But do you expect those two regions in particular to see more of that this year?
I mean, I guess what Steve said earlier, it's hard to predict the future. Obviously, we saw a decrease in APAC last year, but EMEA had an increase as well as the Americas in 2020 for that period. So again, I think for these types of attacks, the attackers are going to go where the money is and where they're actually going to get paid. So if they're going to have success and continuing to have success, they're going to go get similar victims for those types of attacks. So it's hard to say if we'll see increase in APAC or not. The numbers did not show that for 2020. No. So
moving on to talking about groupings, and I think this is an interesting thing that maybe more so in other previous reports, correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like we're talking a lot about the ungroups that we've seen merging, specific APT and FIN groups that have been active this past year. One of the metrics that jumped out to me that I thought was particularly interesting was the note that I think we've seen an almost doubling, 15% to 29% of multiple threat groups active in a victim environment when we responded to a particular breach. And I think that speaks to the necessity and importance of being very careful and accurate in the clustering of the different threat groups. But can you talk a little about in terms of what we were seeing this past year with respect to the number of groups that we, you know, merged, graduated, the number of groups we saw emerge and sort of new groups on the space, and kind of what that speaks to in your mind for how the threat landscape is changing?
Yeah, so we had 650 plus newly tracked groups in 2020, and then 246 that we actually observed during a Mandiant investigation. And then the subset of that, 161 of those were new groups for that year. And so the other half being ones that we were already tracking and had seen. We did a big blog earlier this year, debunking attribution, that really goes into our process. So definitely check that out for the whole merge graduation, like how this groups work, but we do spend an extensive period of time clustering groups and being diligent of keeping those as separate clusters until we have proof and significant overlap between groups. And that merge process really is an extensive process of looking at those overlaps. What TTPs do they share? What malware do they share? What time frame did it happen? Like similar targets, looking at the whole spectrum of the overlaps between these groups and if there are significant overlaps and we can justify and in our minds prove that these two groups are the same, we merge them together based on those similarities. We also did graduate one UNC group into a named APT group, so FIN11, and that was our first FIN graduation since 2017, I believe. And that is a really extensive, even more so than the merge process, like deep dive into this group, fully vetting, figuring out as many individual operator details as possible, really going deep dive into that. And we're saying this is a very clearly defined group and we've tracked it over an extensive period of time. Like this isn't something that just popped up that we think may change. We're very confident that this is an established group, that major group FIN11 that we did this year.
And was that number you mentioned of the number of UNC groups that got merged, was that on par for what we've seen in terms of previous years, or did we do more merging of UNC groups than in previous years?
I don't have the numbers offhand for previous years, but we are trending up. Our team in general is growing. I feel like we're having a little bit of extra cycles to be able to spend this extensive time period on these types of overlaps. And we're getting better at it. There's another blog out, Atomicity. So data science process of looking at the overlaps of these groups and not only like the analyst gut feeling and noticing a couple of things, like actually using the data science to say like, what are the similarities? What group is this most similar to? Over time, we're definitely spending more time on that. We're getting better at it. And we're doing more of these year over year.
I think, too, the groups discussion is a great, like, if I had to give one touch point about, like, the show your work mentality of MTrends, it would be the groups. Because I think this is our second year where we started kind of pulling the curtain back and in MTrends giving the visibility into how many groups we're tracking, where we are seeing them, what we're seeing them do. But that's not new. We've always done that. That has always been a behind-the-scenes motion and a key part of our incident response. And for Regina and I and our team on advanced practices, a key part of what we do. This is directly, when we're working with incident response consultants, and let's say the overall engagement manager, she comes to us and she's like, listen, I need to understand what's going on here. We need to tease out all this activity. Part of our job as advanced practices is to come in and say, okay, this is one group, or this is two groups, or hey, there's at least two here. We don't know what's over here on this third one. We need to figure that out. That has always been part of our incident response process as a company. And we've always found great value in that. And I think the irony is that's how it shows up in MTrends. If you'd have asked me several years ago, would we ever reveal the kind of group tradecraft? I would have said no. Just from a company perspective, we just didn't reveal that. And we didn't talk about those things, especially publicly. And we were in discussions with the IR leadership and their perspective is this matters to us. We spend huge amounts of time on these topics writ large and also in specific engagements. The entire goal of this is to do the right incident response and remediation based on what you're actually dealing with, not, hey, what's kind of a cookie cutter approach. And because that's proven such a valuable tool for us, now it's in MTrends. And I think that's really interesting because this isn't marketing. This isn't something net new because we thought it'd be splashy. We've always done this. And then eventually it got to our point where the incident response leadership just believed that it was important to talk about this publicly. Because again, our goal here is to really say, here's the things that we think are important. We hope this will help inform other organizations. And it became problematic to continue having that discussion and not discuss threat groups and malware clustering because we spend so much time on it and derive so much value out of it.
And this is something that's been interesting to see across the industry. There's obviously a lot of different philosophies around this, particularly around the granularity you get with how specific you get with clustering things off into separate entities. I think the whole process that you sort of detailed around UNCs is a great example of how the intent is to, if we cannot immediately link this to a known threat group, then it gets its own UNC. But also you see some organizations that have very massive threat naming schemas that encompass what we might track as multiple, you know, UNCs or even APT or FIN groups. And I think that at an organizational level, particularly on the business side, you may have some entities that all they care about is that it's North Korea, not that it's specifically APT-37 or APT-38. But from a very tactical standpoint for folks in a SOC that are trying to prioritize which detections should they chase down, or knowing the sort of tools the malware used by specific groups, that seems to make a lot more of a difference. So I guess, what are some of your thoughts around how granular you should strive to be in terms of separating out specific clusters?
Yeah, so I would love to jump on that one. That is a topic very near and dear to my heart and one we talk about a lot. So short answer is the goal, and this is definitely the goal we operate as a company. And then, you know, again, kind of going back to that core task of advanced practices, working with the frontline folks and to suss this out, our answer is as granular as absolutely possible. Like, you can't be granular enough. And I think this is one of the things, it's always easy to look back in hindsight and think about how you could have landed certain concepts differently or discussed them differently. One of the things I think we could have done better, and I love that our company has gone public with how we do clusters, how we do groups. I genuinely love that. It's a really important topic. I think one of the things we probably could have done a little bit better, and we deal with this in MTrends presentations and conversations, is it's important to keep in mind this construct, UNCs into APTs and FINs, it was not designed for ease of use for marketing. It was not designed for ease of explanation. It just wasn't. It was designed for the most detailed, technically driven incident response possible. That's why we have these. And that's got pros and cons. Every model has pros and cons. There are other models that are much easier for a typical person to stand up and talk about or summarize whole swaths of activity in a cleaner fashion than typically some of our service delivery people have had to do. We recognize that. But again, we didn't design it to do that. We designed it to guide incident response. And there's lots of folks that have been around and contributed to this over the years. And the philosophy that was always built in was UNCs are cheap. You can always merge an UNC. You can always decide down the road, oh, I actually created a net new cluster. We did know about that. Let's blow it away. It is designed for technical accuracy. And then the second part is designed to identify how technical intrusions are evolving and then get after that. That's why we have UNCs. That's why this entire model exists. And it's been interesting to watch that model, which we've used for, I mean, as long as we've been around. I think we've had UNCs for all but the first year of Mandiant as a company. And the use of that and the extrapolation of that, I love we talk about it publicly. I think it's got value. But again, it ultimately comes back to we're talking about all of these UNCs and where they're at, because that's how serious we take that granular level. You should be responding to a ransomware group totally different than UNC 2452. If your response and remediation plan cannot deal with those two distinct efforts, you're going to have a bad day because the response is completely different. And that granular tracking down to the specific, I mean, you name a technical detail and we track an UNC to that level because we think it is that important. And it's very easy to get attribution wrong, always has been. But as the landscape continues to get more diverse, it's getting more challenging, which we believe the solve for that is to get more granular. We talk about Cobalt Strike Beacon. Beacons and MTrends multiple times. It was the most prevalent malware family we saw used in intrusions, even though it's not a malware family in and of itself. We see UNC 2452 use it, one of the most advanced groups we have ever seen. We see FIN11 use it. We see everybody use it. It's not enough to track Cobalt Strike Beacon anymore. You have to track the hundreds and hundreds of variations and iterations. And if you cannot, you don't have the ability to suss out, is this UNC 2452 Cobalt Strike Beacon, or is this a pen test? And this is a red team that a company hired, and they're using Cobalt Strike Beacon. That's why we believe that granular nature is so critically important, because when you're in it, and you've got to make a decision right now on what's going to happen next, and that's going to have profound ripple effects, that technical granular detail is what's going to enable that decision making.
Yeah, that's a perfect segue into actually one of the other things that I wanted to ask you guys about is some of the malware stats in here. So you mentioned Beacon. Beacon and Empire both showing up here a lot. Probably no surprise in terms of what if people have been tracking the space and the usage of publicly available tools and malware, things that we see pen testers using, but also, as you mentioned, some of the most advanced threat actors that we track. I thought it was also interesting, and maybe this ties into your point about the variations within Beacon. I'm not sure if it's represented in this number. Let me see if I get this quote right. Of the nearly 300 malware families observed by Mainnet experts during intrusions, 144 malware families were malware families which Mainnet began tracking in 2020. So about half of those new malware families we saw for the first time last year. At the same time, we have this sort of continuation of this trend, which has been going on for several years right now, where some of these publicly available tools are being widely utilized by a range of threat actors. Are some of those variations of Beacon accounted for in that, or how do those two stats kind of play together?
So I guess the broader point here is adversaries absolutely are going to use what's available to them, both in the environment and publicly available tools, to make their lives easier. But we're also, like, half of these malware families are custom to them, that they are innovating, they're adapting, they're doing whatever they need to do to be effective in target environments, and also not using public tools. Like, I guess if it was specific custom, that it was something beyond Beacon itself, it would have been tracked differently. But if it's at its core Beacon, it's tracked as Beacon. So those numbers would possibly be slightly inflated for that Beacon number. But still, at its core, it's still Beacon. It's still that publicly available tool, even if it is using some sort of custom campaign code or thing of that nature. So
what do you make of that trend? You know, again, maybe similar to the ransomware one, I'm asking you to be a little bit predictive in terms of what you might expect to see down the road. But that also doesn't seem to be something that we're going to see an end of anytime soon for a lot of different reasons. I'm sure there's counter forensics and counter attribution reasons why some of those threat actors will gravitate to those tools. Ease of use, modularity might be another one. But I mean, you mentioned 2452, that's a threat actor that we've seen utilize Beacon alongside some of their own custom tools. What do you make of that sort of trend?
I think that it's something that we've seen in the attacker landscape for as long as we've been tracking, is that threat actors are as sophisticated as they need to be in environments, or as they feel they perceive that they need to be in environments. So if Beacon still works, still isn't detected, they aren't kicked out of environments, for all the reasons that you just mentioned, they're going to continue to use it. There's no need to bring out special custom tools that they may blow in this environment and eventually get detected if they can get through this portion of the compromise using a publicly available tool. So Beacon gets discovered, it's really not a huge hit to their potential arsenal that they've spent devving this custom tool. If a custom tool is just discovered in an environment, obviously that's a much greater cost to that threat actor.
I think as well, this really kind of speaks to, you know, the landscape changes for everybody. And I think one thing that we see year over year over year is exactly to Regina's point, the threat actors will do what works, and they'll start at the bottom and they'll work their way up. And we love on the defense side of the house that there are more readily accessible tools that an organization can buy and implement. Everything is much more capable out of the box. That's just a trend that's great for everybody. Same thing on the attacker side. There are more readily available tools that can do more out of the box. The cost of entry can be lower for a certain threat group. So I think that's an important piece. I think the other piece is, again, to kind of keep going back to Regina's points, these actors are learning too, and they've been doing this forever. They have always sought to use the lowest level of skill while also having to not declare who they are. These kinds of tool mixes, the mix of custom and public, the mix of highly evasive, almost single-use malware families with Cobalt Strike Beacon serve that purpose. UNC2452, again, is another great example. We don't know, but we assess part of why they used so little malware is it speaks to the evasive, stealthy nature that was a driving force for them. And then if they do have to use a tool, great. Use a variant of Cobalt Strike Beacon. You blend in like every one of the other hundreds of actors using it versus a super top shelf thing that now we know, like, wait a second. This we've never seen before. We just got our socks blown off. Let's now get after this. Why would they do that? It doesn't serve their purposes for what they're trying to do. So the same mix of custom tools, public tools benefits both the lower end actors and the higher end actors. And again, just to go back to like the specificity, this is why we think that's so important. And then again, one thing that we see, if we move off of Cobalt Strike Beacon and even some of the like custom UNC 2452 tools, we've seen tools that used to be Cardinal become very public. SOGU is a perfect example. It was not that long ago in the olden days when one threat group used SOGU. We knew when we saw SOGU, it was this one threat group. Those days are gone. They're absolutely gone. Everybody uses SOGU. And oh, by the way, SOGU has evolved pretty demonstrably over the years. It's a more capable tool than it was the first time we encountered it. So everyone's evolving, everyone's working, and everyone has different purposes and motivations. And the task is on us to suss that out and make sure we're doing the right thing for the right reason.
Yeah, I think we saw an example of that last year too with APT36, one of their tools that started being utilized by entities we do not believe to be APT36. And that obviously has ramifications, I guess, for how you think about the tool that previously you'd assessed had only been used by one particular threat actor or maybe several actors from a particular sponsoring entity. But I think the point you made about 2452's usage of Beacon, again, is a great reminder, if it had not already been obvious in the last several years, of how assessing threat actors, their capability, solely based on how advanced their malware is or their usage of zero days is not necessarily the best metric for some of the most stealthy of threat actors that we look at. One of the questions I had, I guess, as you mentioned, Regina, at the beginning, this is something that is an ongoing focus of your team, is looking at these trends as they emerge, not just the period of time where you're collating all this for MTrends. But I'm curious, was there anything as you were in the process of putting this all together that surprised you or stood out that maybe wasn't as apparent kind of in your day-to-day up to that point?
I think the best thing about MTrends is that it really is that level set moment of what actually occurred through that time period and what the real trends are, because every responder, every intel analyst, every person that has a piece of this puzzle only sees their piece of the puzzle. So if you go and ask a bunch of different responders, what's the most prevalent thing, or what do you think was the most impactful, they're going to be biased by that set of data that they have available to them. So one person might think that ransomware is a lot more prevalent than it is because they've done only ransomware investigations for the past year, or examples to the other extreme. I think that it's really important that when we get back here that we always go into MTrends with a complete open mind of kind of like, show me what the trend is, rather than coming in like, I want to prove that the X happened in this time period. And like, we definitely get requirements or lists of metrics that, oh, we'd like to show this new thing this year. And sometimes we pull the metrics and we're like, well, that actually wasn't a trend. Or that really was insignificant in this process. I think to Steve's point from earlier, something that always shocks me a little bit is how prevalent financially motivated actors in general, how that's becoming such a bigger piece of the puzzle. And obviously ransomware is a component of that, but to have more than a third be financially motivated, like if we go back to the trends several years ago, like that definitely wasn't the case. So it definitely shows that shift in the total threat actor landscape over the years.
All right, final question. And I'm taking UNC 2452 and FIN 11 off the table, but favorite threat actor from this past year? Ooh. If you had to pick one.
UNC 1878, probably for my favorite of the last year, but FIN 7 is hands down my all-time favorite.
Any particular reason why for UNC 1878?
I just respect their tradecraft, I guess, and the consistency of it. I guess it's the same for FIN 7. Like, I always looked at FIN 7 as like they're professionals. Like, this is like an actual business to them. And like, there's, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't have respect for them, but on some level, like, you kind of respect like their process. It isn't just a random hack. There is intent and true motivation behind that. So.
That's a good point. Steve?
Man, I think for the last year, it'd be hard not to have it be UNC 2452. We spent a significant amount of time working against that group, learning that group. And I think what I really grew to appreciate about UNC 2452, and we kind of really had to get our heads around, is I think one of the things that has been underappreciated about that group is They do all the little things right. It's not unusual that we see a group try to be evasive, and they do certain things in a certain part of the attack lifecycle to be evasive, and they are, but then we pivot left and right, and we can get back on the trail, and we can find them, and now we're after it. And as we would go after that with UNC 2452, we would pivot and be like, oh, wow, they're just as dedicated here. This is crazy. Okay, let's pivot again. Oh, wow, they're just as dedicated here. And it was a group that clearly understands incident response, which is rare. They really understood and in many ways anticipated some of the things we were going to do, which made that highly challenging. And on a purely personal level, I have never worked with so many professionals on a single group, which is probably why I like UNC 2452 the most. We brought in so many experts from so many parts of our own company, and then also some of our partners to really try to get our arms around that. And that's unusual. That's not normally, as an industry, how we come to understand groups. We all kind of work it on our own, and we deal with people who are directly involved, and then, you know, we talk about it. This was totally different. Responding to UNC 2452 had a totally different feel, which kind of gives them a special place in my heart for this year.
Okay, well, that's a good answer. So I'll allow UNC 2452 for that one. But Steve, Regina, thank you both for your time and all the work that your team and others at FireEye spent on this report. For anyone that has not yet, please go check this out. There's several Bright Talk webinars that Steve and Regina have done as well. Check those out. Steve, you're on Twitter. Where can people find you?
I'm StonePwn3000 on Twitter, and that's about it. I'm pretty social media light, except for that.
Excellent. And Regina?
Similar. I'm Regina Elwell. So I am myself.
Fantastic. Well, great insights as always. Great talking to you both.
Thanks for having us on,
Luke.
Take care.